The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly and another trip across the circuit board of life. I'm Alex Kratosky, and joining me in the pod are our regular podites, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Bobby Johnson has been banned from the Tech Weekly pod this week because we feel he's just too overexposed. So welcome to you both and thank you very much for coming.
Hello!
Well, while the technology world is fixated with the ongoing ballet between Yahoo, Microsoft, News Corp and AOL, or the continuing privacy dispute between digital rights groups and online advertiser Form, I, personally, was thrilled to hear that 3D movies are back with the announcement from Disney and Pixar that all of their future releases will be in 3D. You see, I'm a long-term film gimmick obsessive, fascinated by the ploys cooked up by William Castle, who was a bit of a madman. He shocked audiences with mild electrical currents during The Tingler. And I'm also obsessed with the one-eyed 3D auteur André Titoff. Did you know he had only one eye?
I didn't even know he was an auteur.
Did you not? Oh, well, he died recently. I was obsessed with him. He apparently made the very best 3D movie that there ever was. And he only had one eye, he couldn't actually see the 3D.
I feel great that in the knowledge that we have a specialist in this niche area.
Yeah, believe me, I'm a specialist.
On that team.
Ask me more.
That's anyway. University challenge sorted out, isn't it?
Yeah. So if all cinemas are going to be converted into 3D show houses, which movies would you like to see converted into 3D?
Oh, that's an easy one. It's got to be Wizards of Oz. Wizards of Oz.
Wizards of Oz. The Wiz.
I wish I had a heart.
Yeah, oh, that one.
I love that American accent.
Oh, well, for me, I watched Bender's Big Score, which is the new Futurama straight-to-DVD movie last night. So I think, obviously, that should be in 3D.
Obviously.
Can't you have a 2D cartoon in 3D? Why not?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's effectively what they're going to be doing. Anyway, let's leave that weird and fanciful world behind for now and instead talk about relationships with robots. On this week's program, we welcome Peter McCowan from Queen Mary at the University of London to discuss a new European-wide research initiative looking into the future of robot-supported living. We also delve deeper into the latest aggressive tactics in the Three Strikes and You're Out saga between the music industry and internet service providers. Plus, we've got the latest news from the technosphere and your insights on what's been going on in the world via the blogs. There's plenty to sink your teeth into on this week's Tech Weekly Tour de Force, so grab your e-passport and jump on board. Robots are possibly the coolest things on Earth. Revered, yet at the same time vilified, our culture has an uncertain relationship with mechanized men that cuts to the very crux of who we are and what we believe. The debates in science fiction about robots and humans touch on the ethical and the philosophical. But it's not just the geeks who are transfixed. Blockbusters are obsessed with them too, in awe yet fearful about what these unknown quantities mean for who we are and what happens when our creations get out of control. As scientists devise ever more intelligent mechanical systems, the questions that once seemed far future fantasies are coming closer to reality. We're still a long way off the dystopias created in movies like The Terminator or AI, but we're increasingly welcoming robots into our lives and into our homes. Thankfully, we're not going into this without a plan. In a move reminiscent of Isaac Asimov's iRobot, a pan-European research consortium of academics is examining the relationships between humans and robots. Peter McCowan from Queen Mary at the University of London is part of that project. Welcome to Tech Weekly.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Peter, can you tell me a little bit more about the scope of this project?
Well, this project is looking at how we can develop robots and graphical representations of robots' avatars such that over a long period of time in real social settings, human users feel a genuine empathy, a kind of companionship with the robots. Previously, a lot of research in kind of robot-human interaction had been done in laboratory settings and over a fairly short period of time. And what we're trying to do with this project is see how far the technology and our understanding of the way that a companionship relationship builds actually transforms over into real situations over a long period of time.
What are the actual outcomes of the project?
Well, there are a number of outcomes. What one of the key ones, obviously, is to be able to try to produce a first set of robots where there is a genuine feeling of companionship that you want to be with that robot, that robot is actually giving you something useful in the way of a relationship. So there's the kind of technical outputs from it. But because it's a research project, there are a number of other broader issues that we're looking at. In particular, how do you go about measuring the quality of a relationship? Because this is clearly one of the issues that is important if you're trying to build these robots. You need to measure how well they're doing what they're doing. And one of the other major areas that we're looking at in here is the kind of long-term ethical frameworks that we want to start to consider about developing these sorts of robots.
These outcomes seem very human centered. They seem to be about the human relationship with the robot. Are you looking to turn that back on itself? I mean, I'm thinking about in AI. You know, there's that the plot there is that there's an empathic robot who's there to fill a gap in a mourning family's life. And it's eventually discarded because it no longer fulfills that role. Hmm. But the robot itself is still empathic and feels great love for the mother in this particular scenario. Are you looking sort of at the reverse scenario and questioning the relationship there?
We're looking certainly at how to build these empathetic machines who have some form of social intelligence rather than just kind of computational intelligence, social intelligence. They understand something about your emotional state, the expression on your face, the body language, the kind of gestures that you're giving. As to whether or not at some point those creations have some kind of internal real genuine empathy, almost a kind of social soul or not, those are questions for philosophical discussions. At the moment, we are merely building the robots, the software, and doing the experiments.
Why robots? Why not just sort of computers? Because I would have thought that it'd be simpler to build a computer, you know, take a computer, load the software into it, so that you had a computer that might be empathic. You wouldn't need to do the embodiment that's implied by having a robot.
We're actually doing both of those, and one of the other parts to the project is to look at a phenomena called migration. So we're building robot entities, robot personalities, which are there within a robot body. But what happens when you take that personality, that entity, and then transfer it from a robot body into a PDA, for example, or onto some kind of graphical representation as an avatar? So the question there is, does the relationship that you had when instantiated in a body in the robot actually carry over to when that entity is now no longer physically in front of you, but is there on a PDA or whatever? It's similar to, I suppose, in some ways, the fact that when you have a friend, you also know that's that friend and it's the same friend when you're speaking on the phone, when they're not physically in front of you.
Isn't part of the problem, though, that humans are very good at fooling themselves that they're getting an empathic response from something when they're not at all? So people think that their cats are reacting to them in one way, and actually the cats don't care. They just see you as a big, you know, sort of thing to get the tins open. And, you know, Joseph Weizenbaum, who died recently, the writer of the ELIZA program, which lots of people might have on their computers, even if they don't know it, which simply threw back a bit of your sentence in this sort of non-directed way. And there were people who, though they knew intellectually that it was a software program which was doing nothing more than just throw things back, they found themselves emotionally thinking, this is responding to me. Surely that's part of the problem, that it's so hard to separate out our desire to anthropomorphize and to be empathic with things which are completely indifferent to us.
I don't see that actually as being the problem. I see that as being part of the solution to what we're doing. We're obviously not going to be able to build systems that have a tremendous deep level of ability as human beings do, because we don't understand how those things are actually generated in human beings to begin with. So what we're hoping for is that empathizing, that ability to anthropomorphize, even in cases where perhaps some of the interactions are a little bit clunky, that humans will afford some kind of feeling of relationship in there.
Now, you're talking psychology. Effectively. And I'm wondering what the different, because it's a consortium and there are various international groups, disciplines that are coming together. What are those disciplines and who is involved in creating this artificial intelligence in some way? What different types of people are involved in this project?
We have a very broad range of different skills being brought to the table. My own background is a fairly mixed interdisciplinary one. My first degrees were in physics, but I also have degrees in psychology as well as kind of the computing disciplines. We have a German university who are social psychologists. We have a number of people who specialize in interaction design and how do you build technology to be easier to use. But we also in this project have something that's fairly unique, which is a group in Hungary who are specialists in dog behavior, dog ethologists, as they're called, to give them the proper name. So the idea of using dogs as a model, the kind of relationship that humans have with pets, is one way of beginning to think of a framework that you could possibly work into. But we also have a number of companies on board as well who are interested in the potential towards the end of this project, and it's a fairly long project running over about 5 years, to look at whether or not some of that technology can be taken forward, probably primarily into the toy market as kind of empathetic toys to play with.
Do you have ethicists, philosophers, those types of people involved in this, isn't it?
There are people within the consortium who have specialised in looking at exactly that, looking at the importance of understanding the kind of ethical background to doing this. And one of the things that's coming out of this project is a set of ethical guidelines that are validated across cultures, because what may be considered okay in one part of the world might not be in another. And certainly if you look at Japan, their view towards robots tends to be very different from the view in Western cultures.
I'm a robot novice, I confess, but I know that quite a lot of the research into robotics is done by the military industry, and it's very interesting to talk about robots developing a kind of social awareness or perhaps even some kind of level of morality. Mm. Have you kind of explored or discussed what might happen when those two things collide, when you've got robots with a kind of military purpose that have their own ethical awareness?
The first thing to say is that we aren't touching the robotics for military purposes in this project. It is about developing companions. But there was a conference recently where one of the points that was being made was that if you are looking at a military situation, it's possible that robots will be more ethical combatants than human beings are, because they have built into them a series of rules and regulations that they will not transcend, as opposed to human beings who can then decide that they're going to kill because, you know, the blood was up in them, losing the rag. Whether or not that's something that we as a society are happy with, again, it's about dialogue, it's about debate, and I think that the more people understand about the technologies, what the technologies are capable of, the more we're likely to be able to have those kinds of informed debates. And it's something I'm very interested in, is ensuring that as we move along, particularly in areas like artificial intelligence and so on, where there can be a misconception by members of the public as to quite what the technologies are and what the technologies are possibly capable of, that's something that you kind of dialogue with as you go along.
Well, thank you very much. That was fascinating, and I'm definitely looking forward to following this as this plays out. You can read more about the debate and the project online at guardian.co.uk/technology. And if you have any thoughts on who you think should be involved in robot AI design, please do send us an email to tech@guardian.co.uk or give us a ring on our Skype line, which is Guardian Tech Weekly. We'll read out the best answers or play the best robot impressions on next week's show. Now, enough of all this future think. Let's find out what's actually been happening. Here's Jemima with the news.
Biddy biddy. The BBC's head internet honcho, Ashley Highfield, is leaving the post after 8 years to become chief executive of Project Kangaroo, the joint web TV project being developed by BBC Worldwide, ITV and Channel 4. Former Microsoft executive Eric Huggers, currently controller of Future Media and Technology, is tipped to take over. New figures show 90% of UK web users watch video online, but the rapid growth is causing problems for ISPs, who say the network is already struggling to cope with the extra traffic. The ISPs blame the BBC's iPlayer for much of the growth and say the broadcaster should share the cost of data-heavy video. But outgoing internet chief Ashley Highfield rejected that and insisted the BBC was just one player in a rapidly evolving market. Several pro-Tibet campaign sites have been hacked, it was claimed last week, exploiting a well-known vulnerability that allowed the hackers to plant tracking devices and remotely control the machines. The sites have seen a massive increase in traffic since global demonstrations during the Olympic torch relay. The latest twists in the Yahoo takeover. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation has been discussing how it could back up Microsoft's bid, potentially combining MySpace and MSN, and putting in more cash for the Yahoo bid. Yahoo, in turn, has been talking to AOL over a reported merger, which could see Time Warner taking a 20% stake in Yahoo. And all that follows the announcement that Yahoo would be running a 2-week trial of Google Ads on around 3% of its US search results. Anyone else?
Jemima, this Highfield incident, as it shall forthwith be known, the Highfield incident, has shocked quite a few people. Can you talk a little bit more about what's going on?
Yeah, just this kind of came out of nowhere until you start thinking about it and then talking to people in the BBC, and they're like, it seems like there's been this big plan for a very long time that, you know, how's Ashley Highfield going to leave the BBC? Because he can't possibly go anywhere in this job. He can't get more senior. And so obviously the only thing he could do would move out. And somebody rather unkindly said, you know, who's going to have him? So it turns out the BBC is going to have him in a sort of in another incarnation to head up Project Kangaroo.
Which is a joint venture, and joint ventures are always poison.
Oh, God. Yeah. How many cooks in that soup?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of them. There's Channel 4, ITV and BBC Worldwide, which is the commercial arm of the BBC. And what they're trying to do is a similar kind of remit to the iPlayer, which is to take web TV to the mainstream. But they'll have a commercial remit to do it. So they'll be repurposing archive from the BBC's catalogue and also from those other broadcasters. Notably, Five isn't involved, and Sky, read into that what you will.
Just briefly, you mentioned the archive. Is that existing digital archive or is that everything?
Well, this is the commercial archive of BBC Worldwide. So this is all the stuff that they have a license to use around the world. So the details for Project Kangaroo are still sketchy, and it hasn't yet been approved by the BBC Trust and would need to be, as it would by the boards of ITV and Channel 4 as well. So it's still all a bit up in the air, but it could be
that sounds like job safety, doesn't it?
So it doesn't have any articles of association, and it hasn't got any money, but they've got a vague idea that they want to have something which is streaming, which is going to be a joint venture between not two, which is usually the maximum number of companies you get for these things, but three companies exploiting an archive using a player technology which might be Flash, which might be Adobe Media. And it sounds like...
Well, Ashley Highfield clearly thinks it's worth a go because he's just given up a £350,000 job to take it on. So he's putting his money where his mouth is, I suppose.
And the person who's coming, who is tipped to take over, how do you think that this is going to move forward?
Well, I've already spoken to three people in a very short amount of time about this. And Eric Huggers is very heavily tipped to take over. And actually, if you look at how he was taken on, it kind of looks like a Blair Brown-style coronation where, you know, he was taken on not even a year ago from after 9 years at Microsoft. And it's almost a kind of handover of power.
What did he do at Microsoft?
All sorts of stuff, but basically business development on the kind of media side of Windows Media.
I mean, I'm sure lots of the people listening will be asking, will he be platform agnostic? Because I think Ashley Highfield, wasn't it, who was the guy who said, oh, we only have 300 Linux users or something, or 30 or something.
Well, their argument was, you know, we have to cater for the mainstream first. So obviously they had to kind of get Microsoft on board and get the memorandum of understanding. But yes, they are pushing their services out to Linux and Mac as well. But I'm sure Eric Huggers will be very aware that there are a lot of people watching to see if he's a bit too Microsoft inclined.
So if you'd like to know more about this, then you can head over to blogs.guardian.co.uk/digital content.
Correct.
And also, I'm sure there will be something on guardian.co.uk/technology. Several weeks ago, we discussed the power play between the music industry and internet service providers off the back of the three strikes and you're out recommendations from the UK government. Since that time, little has been resolved, and both sides are becoming increasingly antagonistic. Last week, Matt Phillips from the BPI, the group which represents the British recording industry, sent an angry letter with a two-week deadline to ISPA, the group representing ISPs. Charles, how did we get here?
Well, Alex, the BPI has been taking people to court after getting their details from ISPs where it is evidence that they've been file-sharing copyrighted materials. But it's also been suggesting to ISPs for the past 18 months that they should introduce a three-strikes-and-out policy. You get two warnings, and on the third warning, your internet connection would be cut. Then suddenly, at the start of April, it sent a very aggressive letter to ISPs demanding that they should introduce this measure within 2 weeks or else it would take out an injunction against them. So I asked Matt Phillips of the BPI, why a two-week deadline and what sort of injunctions could it take out?
You have to set some time frame in order to elicit a response. And I would refute the suggestion that it's aggressive for us to put a time frame upon which negotiations could continue. I mean, we have been very, very patient. We have been working at this for 18 months, and that quite apart from the fact that you would think that socially responsible internet service providers would be putting policies in place in any case.
But it also talks about an injunction. What sort of injunction could you take out?
Well, we do have legal rights here. Now, we have chosen not to enforce those rights within the last 18 months. We've been entirely focused on being progressive here, but we do have legal rights and we can enforce them by injunction.
The ISPs respond that they don't see why you're bringing them into the picture. You've been for some years now, the BPI and the IFPI, which is the international music industry, has been suing people who it's identified as uploading or downloading, and has had, as far as I know, 100% record in doing that in the cases that have come to court or where it's brought them through. Why do you want to change what, you know, apparently is a working model for you?
That's a very good question. I think that the problems that we have in terms of that approach is firstly that by the time you get to the position whereby you've identified a consumer, you've already incurred an incredible amount of legal cost. And I don't believe, and this is a personal position, that necessarily overburdening a one individual consumer with all of those legal costs isn't necessarily a fair way to go. I would suggest that a far more practical way to do it is for us, instead of taking that information and evidence to a court, going through a court process and bringing legal actions against a consumer, it's far more practical to send that information onto an ISP and ask them to enforce their own terms and conditions.
But the ISPs object that you're, in effect, passing on the legal responsibility to them. If the person who's being accused says, no, nothing to do with me, you know, if you run into someone who is either the child of a barrister or is themselves a very high-powered barrister, that the barrister will take whoever takes this action against them to court. And if it's the ISP, they'll find themselves having to rely on your evidence, which, you know, their lawyers will say to them, actually, we can't verify this evidence because it came to us from the BPI, and it in effect becomes a sort of legal form of hearsay. The ISPs aren't happy about the idea that they're going to be given left holding the legal ball while being at risk of being sued by their customers.
I mean, we've spoken about this before, Charles, and the legal responsibility in the event that there is a mistaken identity is a debate to have.
But that's why it seems so strange to have set this two-week deadline and then offer to injunct people.
I'm not convinced that that is a real sticking point. And if ISPs are saying to us, then that is a clear sticking point, and we would adopt this three-step process if you would overcome this problem, then that's something that we obviously need to talk about. If we look at the question of mistaken identity, I'm not aware of any case ever in all of the cases that have been brought where there has been a genuine case of mistaken identity.
Although, well, there's been some in the States, hasn't there?
I think the cases in the States, and I'm not an expert on this, and I may be wrong, and it's for the RIAA to clarify this, but my understanding is the cases of so-called mistaken identity have in fact been, as in the example that you cited, when someone's child has been using the broadband account and the internet account holder has been landed with the bill. Now, there is a legal question there. Now, what I would say is that the internet account holder is the one that signs up for the terms and conditions, and under those terms and conditions, they say very clearly that if this account is used unlawfully, then you stand to lose that account, you stand to lose that connection. Now, under our three-step process, one of the first things that we would suggest an ISP do is to say, look, there's a couple of things that you can do here. First, have a conversation with the family. Make it clear that using a peer-to-peer network and making available copyrighted music in a user-friendly language is something that is unlawful and something that you could potentially lose your internet account for. Also, equally, securing a wireless network.
You've sent this letter out to a number of ISPs. Have any of them come back and said, yeah, this sounds like a good idea, we'll go along with you?
I don't want to put any ISP in the spotlight by suggesting that any one of them is more progressive or otherwise in their thinking than the others. So for that reason, I don't want to answer that question.
But even if three or four or five of them have said, yeah, we think this is a great idea, you know, even little ones, doesn't matter. Just a vague number who have come back and said, yeah, you know, we're with you on this, we'll start instituting this.
We're still talking to all of the major ISPs. And Carphone Warehouse, TalkTalk have been the first to say, and rule them out of the running, if you like.
There was a big survey came out from British music rights, Fergal Shottyheads, which was looking at the extent to which piracy is a problem. And it seemed to identify not downloading, but home copying as the real source of the problem there, you know, the playground swapping of CDs and so on. Is the BPI's focus really where the trouble is? Isn't the problem that actually the tools of this, you know, destruction, if you like to call it, are actually in the hands of the people who don't, you know, necessarily need the internet?
I don't disagree that offline sharing of files is a problem. Whether or not offline sharing of music is a bigger problem than file sharing, I'm not convinced. I certainly do believe that unlawful file sharing is something that underpins all of these problems, and they extend from it, which is why it's remained the focus of our efforts. So I wouldn't disagree.
It's part of the problem that people don't put a value on music. You know, that when you get a CD given away with a newspaper and you throw away the newspaper and keep the CD, music has in effect devalued itself by becoming so pervasive that people don't think that there's any value to it anymore.
I can understand how a consumer wouldn't perhaps appreciate and understand the business model that gives the music for free on the front of a paper, and then why other music is paid for. That I do concede. But I think people can appreciate and understand that we do need to be paid somehow. Now, clearly, if a newspaper or a media partner is willing to offer you a substantial sum for some of your music, and that sum is significantly outweighed by what you would achieve through sales, then that is a sensible business decision to make. I think the biggest problem, as I say, is the premium of access to music at any one time that one would get through CDs has been devalued by the fact that everything is now effectively available for free for those who are quite willing to park all of the moral and ethical decisions that you might make. And there's always going to be a substantial proportion of people that will get that music for free, and that's a problem that you have to address.
Charles, we've spent a lot of time talking about this issue, but we already know what the major issues are at stake. What's moved forward here? What's happening here?
Well, it's this, you know, it's this letter which sometime later on this week, by the 18th of April, is going to either be acted on, you know, either the BPI is going to have to start injuncting ISPs, as it claims it can, or else it's going to have made an idle threat, which is always a bad thing to do in business. So I think that there's something of a problem. ISPs can stall for quite a while. And given just the wider things that are happening in politics with all the discussion about, you know, where Gordon Brown is, where he should be, what he shouldn't be doing, the fact that the Culture and Media Support has put out this consultation paper which was talking about legislation sometime next year, I'd say that that's not necessarily a given. I suspect that political winds are blowing, that it's difficult to promise that sort of legislation, even if you think it's a good idea. Undoubtedly, the record labels are hurting badly, but equally, ISPs are hurting badly, and they're hurting for other reasons, and taking their customers to court is not something that the ISPs are keen to do.
Do you actually see that happening? Because ultimately, if the BPI and the other music industry organizations aren't taking individuals to court, then it's the ISPs are going to be. I just see this as a massive money sink for both parties.
It's certainly a time sink, and possibly a money sink. I mean, I just can't actually see what the BPI has that it can injunct an ISP over. I mean, what has it been doing exactly?
I think that their mission is to try and get as many people's backs up as possible. And with the internet users on enough, let's try and get the ISP's backs up as well.
People see this in the melodrama fashion, which is that, you know, you have your big villain, boo, everyone hates the BPI. But actually, no, they're people who, you know, go there and they have mortgages and they have children, and they're entirely normal people who just want to go out and earn their money like everyone else. And they're seeing their business being destroyed, in effect, by what they see as lots of people acting illegally.
Yeah, but they also don't want to change how they operate their businesses, and they absolutely have to change their businesses if they're going to adapt.
Except they do want to change how their business works, but at the same time, they don't want to see the carpet torn out behind them while they're still trying to run forward onto the bit that's being laid in front of them.
But that's the dilemma that every media business
is having. That's true.
If they had seen file sharing, for example, as a really positive, powerful distribution method rather than seeing it as something to try and extinguish, then the music industry would be very, very different now.
Well, thank you very much, Charles, and also to Matt. We'll have more on this story as it plays out. Well, I think we've done just about all the opinionating we need to on this week's show, so now it's time for us to hand the mic over to you. What's been going on over on the blogs? Jemima?
Oh, yes. Well, Facebook settled that rather inconvenient court case, which involved other dudes from Harvard complaining that Mark Zuckerberg had pinched their idea. Anyway, they settled out of court. Unfortunately, we don't know how much for. But Facebook will be very pleased to see the end of this deal because, aside from anything else, there were some rather embarrassing diary entries that popped up that Zuckerberg had written while he was at college. So this is October 28th, 2003. No, okay, I'm not going to do the voice. But
this whole journalism thing doesn't pan out, you know, you could definitely go into impressions.
I could join the Muppets. No, it's fine. 9:48 p.m. I'm a little intoxicated, not going to lie. So what if it's not even 10 p.m. and it's a Tuesday night? The Kirkland Facebook is open on my desktop computer and some of these people have pretty horrendous Facebook pics. I almost want to put some of these faces next to pictures of farm animals and have people vote on which is more attractive. We can see the seeds from which Facebook was born. So, yes, a couple of amusing comments on
it's
this.
It's more like, but, am I cow or not, isn't it?
Yeah. Finden Lake said, and that's from the diary of the man who created Facebook? So much for karma. And then Simon something said, hey, Zuckerberg, putting people's pictures of farm animals and voting on who is more attractive was my idea. Where do I sign up to sue?
Very good. Well, over on the games blog, we want everybody to know that it's not all fun and frolic. Economic recession has been the topic this week. Keith popped up a post when he asked readers how long the economy would have to go down before they stopped buying the relatively expensive games. Because, you know, it's like 40 quid for a new game. So that's out of pocket, pretty
expensive.
Big. Absolutely. So most people currently opt for buying pre-owned games, which, interestingly enough, is illegal according to the games industry in the same way that the BPI is having issues with file sharing. The games industry doesn't like very much people buying pre-owned games because then they lose out on the revenue.
But hang on, so how come those are in every game shop that I walk into?
I don't know, but there are people inside the games industry who are adamant and they make big fists and they shake them at conferences and say, you gamers, you're doing bad. You are being illegal.
Right.
So anyway, the point is that there are lots of people who already buy pre-owned and in fact, many people who, when they expect to feel the crunch, they say that they're happy to forego their nights out in favor of a game.
Like why am I not surprised by this on the game floor?
Indeed.
All like those mad socialites.
Crazy going out meeting people. Like Rihanna says, I find games save me money by reducing the amount of time I spend in the pub or on going out or anything that involves spending money in order to enjoy oneself. If a game cost me, you know, £35, then in the first night alone, I've made a saving, which means that he goes out large generally. Therefore, over the lifetime of games, it will probably save me hundreds of pounds. The recession simply means more gaming time, not less. I'm not sure if this is healthy or not. So clearly he has a bit of insight into the fact that he's not breaking any stereotypes there.
Oh, okay. You could just buy Tetris once and just sit there playing it forever.
You're a simple man with simple pleasures, Charles, aren't you? Well, what's happening over on the technology blog?
The issue of how Apple got its Safari browser or sneaked its Safari browser onto people's PCs in the guise of a quote update to iTunes has been rumbling on, and there was a bank which found that it had got some people who downloaded Safari, installed it, even though Safari has some notable security holes. And so there was a post that Jack Schofield wrote about companies struggle to remove Apple Safari browser. And this response comes from Jack, actually. I know the last week's did as well, but Jack's quite good at these sorts of one-liners, I've got to say. And he was taking someone else's comment apart. And someone else said, you ask yourself almost as a footnote, why employees of a bank are able to freely install downloaded software? And Jack said, it's a footnote. I thought it was the punchline. But we also had a discussion about the Neil Thompson interview in the technology section and, of course, on this podcast last week, in which Fazer noted that Neil Thompson came across very badly. And I'm baffled by a sudden turnabout into digital distribution. This is given that the Xbox, which was going to be HD DVD has gone down the pan. Suddenly he's saying that, it's not about the disc, it's all about digital distribution. From what Bobby has said, Thompson just seemed to put his hands in his ears and tried to pretend that he wasn't listening when it was pointed out that the Xbox is not particularly competitive on price or portability.
My goodness.
La, 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 la.
Anyway, if you've got something to say, please do let us know at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/games or /digital content or all three, or send us an email at tech@guardian.co.uk or, I mean, listen, the communication opportunity
the plethora
is
of opportunities.
Panoply. Give us a ring on our Skype hotline, which is Guardian Tech Weekly. Your moments of internet fame await.
I'm Alok Jha, and on your latest edition of Science Weekly, when did the Western world start to think scientifically? Philip Balls joins us in the pod to shed light on the crucial but hidden story in the history of rational thought. Also in the show...
The biblical history is that dinosaurs and people, because all land animals and people are made on the same date. They lived at the same time.
Ken Ham from the creationist group Answers in Genesis tells us about dragons, dinosaurs, and why he believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. And we'll be finding out why 20% of scientists admit to using brain-enhancing drugs. It's all in the latest Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
Brain-enhancing drugs.
Does this mean drugs testing in science?
Fantastic. Anyway.
101%.
Well, we're almost out of time this week. But before we go, Charles, it's time for you to take the floor. What's hitting the shelves in this week's tech section?
We're looking at how BT is going to be rolling out its ADSL 2+ technology for broadband, which will mean from the end of this month and rolling out through to about 2012 or so, speeds of up to 24 megabits per second from your exchange, though probably most people won't see very much difference. For Frio Data, we're looking at the National Land and Property Gazetteer, which will be a complete list of addresses throughout the UK. But although it's been compiled by local government associations, we're wondering why it's not freely available. We look at the history of Pong and the guy who wrote it, careers leap into new technologies, reviewing the SatMap GPS, which has ordnance survey maps in huge detail. Seth Finkelstein writes about SensorWare. Vic Keegan looks at Flickr's move into video, and Jack Schofield on the successor to Vista.
Thank you very much. You can read all about it on Thursday or online at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's it from us. But before we go, listener Berzel has a request. He says that he has an idea for an app for the iPhone, but he lacks the skills to develop it. So he wants to know where he can find his technological foil.
I don't know. Our Facebook group wouldn't be a bad place to start, would it?
Very good idea. The I Love the Guardians Technology podcast.
Do you see what I did there?
Yeah, I did. That was seamless. Charles, do you know of any sort of iPhone...
I don't know. I think you ask the lazy web, you know. Lazy web, have great idea. Show me iPhone chops.
Rob's your uncle. Well, if anyone else has any ideas, please do get in touch and help us to help this poor developerless creative soul. In the meantime, thanks as always to our team of fabulous potters, Jemima, Charles, and producer Scott over there in the glass box.
Aye.
Thanks as well to our guests, Matt Phillips from the BPI and Peter McGowan from Queen Mary. I'm Alex Kratosky. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.